this Forthright Radio for January 4th, 2017. I'm Joy LaClaire. With us for the full hour today is John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. His dystopian novel, Splinterlands, has just been published by Haymarket Books. It's set in 2050, when the U.S. Capitol has been moved to Kansas City after the devastating floods of Hurricane Donald, and the country has broken up into more or less autonomous regions, including, quote, the crazy country of Northern California, end of quote. It is a very interesting, edifying read. John Pfeffer is also the author of several other books, including Crusade 2.0, and Foamers, written under the pen name John Burson. He has worked as an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. But today, we'll be focusing on his latest book, Splinterlands, published by Haymarket Books in December 2016. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, I'm really delighted to have you, John. Your book, Splinterlands, takes the form of a sort of memoir, a first-person narrative set in the year 2050. Bestseller, Splinterlands, was published in 2020 and was hailed by Adam Hochschild as, quote, a masterful blend of explicit history and implicit futurology, end of quote. Which we learn from a footnote by another first-person commentator, Emmanuel Puig. Splinterlands opens with Julian West recalling that 25 years before, he had sat on the roof of his two-story house in Washington, D.C., as the floods of Hurricane Donald ruined the capital of his country. It sounds at least a little bit prescient, but you have written, and I'm quoting, Splinterlands was not intended to be a depiction of current events. I didn't think that Britain would vote to leave the European Union last June, nor did I think Donald Trump would win the November elections, end of quote. So I have to ask you, John, just when did you begin writing Splinterlands, and what were you thinking?
It's an important question. So I started writing an essay last November, that would be in 2016, rather 2015.
Wait, hold on just a second. Are you saying 1-5 or 1-6?
1-5, 2015.
Okay, good.
And it was an essay that was about kind of, it was supposed to be about a big picture piece on where the world was heading. And my editor said, you know, look, we're entering into this kind of confusing relationship between the United States and the European Union and Russia. So sit down and just kind of tell us what's going to happen. And I thought, well, that's going to be tough, but let me think about it. So I sat down at my computer and I thought, the future, what's the future going to look like? And I realized that the term big picture was probably not the right phrase because, well, when we think about the future, or when we did think about the future back in 2015, we were thinking about things getting bigger. We were thinking about the global economy getting bigger. We were thinking about the European Union getting bigger. We were thinking about all the kind of steps forward that the world would take towards a more globalized future, basically. But I realized that, well, that might not be what's happening. You know, we might not be actually moving towards something bigger. We might be moving towards something smaller. In fact, we might be looking at some of the biggest kind of entities in the world today falling apart, like the European Union, like international organizations, like the International Criminal Court. So that was kind of the beginning of my thinking that led to Splinterlands, this essay that I wrote in November of 2015. And after it was published, it was a relatively popular kind of exercise in futurology. My editor said, well, why don't you turn this into a book? And I thought, well, I'm not so sure that people will be interested in reading a whole book about, you know, kind of what the future looks like, kind of this idea of the Splinterlands concept. But maybe if I turned it into a novel, maybe if, in addition to kind of why did the world fall apart, readers would be reading about why one particular family fell apart. Maybe that would be of interest to people. And so that was kind of the beginning of this idea. I wrote the essay in November of 2015, and I started writing the book basically in December of 2015 and finished it a little bit later in early 2016.
Well, it's what I would call a big little book. It's only 150 pages, but you have some pretty big concepts in it, some of which I think are original to you. Did you have as much fun writing it as I had reading it?
Well, as you quoted me, the when I wrote it, I wasn't really thinking that reality would begin to conform to what I was writing. And so, yes, I did have fun, you know, because the book was meant to be a kind of a wake-up call that even though the European Union had survived, you know, the Brexit vote, and even though, you know, Donald Trump was not elected in November, and you know, prior to these events, of course, all of the public opinion polls suggested that, of course, Brexit was going to fail and that Donald Trump was going to fail. So the book was intended to be, you know, kind of a wake-up call that even though we dodged those bullets, these trends were long-term trends, and we should still expect that the European Union was going to face some serious challenges, and that the constituency that was supporting Donald Trump leading up to the November election, they weren't going to go away, they weren't going to leave the country in disgust when Hillary Clinton was elected, and that they would still have an important political impact on the country. And so, yes, Splinterlands is supposed to be the book that says, hey, you know, this future is still a possibility, even if you think that we've avoided these worst-case scenarios. So as I was writing it, yes, absolutely. I had a lot of fun kind of thinking about the future, imagining how this one family would kind of adapt to all of these rapidly changing events. And, you know, I think a lot of people today, as they are kind of heading into 2017, they can relate to kind of the onslaught, the onrush, the avalanche of changes that are taking place in the world, and, you know, trying to kind of, you know, deal with it. And that's essentially what this book is about.
Okay, so chapter one, which is entitled The Great Unraveling, begins, quote, "Water boils most fiercely just before it disappears, and so it is evidently with human affairs," end of quote. Julian West then goes on to note the cultural climates before the war to end all wars began in 1914, the Nazis took over in 1933, and the USSR imploded in 1991. Then again, since this is a memoir history, when in 2018, just before the Great Unraveling. So would you please expand on this, first about the history we know, and then the Great Unraveling in 2018?
Sure. So I think, you know, looking back into the past, of course, we believe that everything is inevitable because it happened, you know, and we don't kind of have a sense of how history branches and how various alternatives are possible at any given time. When we look back at the year 1913, we think, well, of course, everything was leading up to the outbreak of World War I and this clash of great empires and so on that took place at that time. What we don't really realize is that people who were living in 1913 didn't necessarily think that the world was going to immediately fall apart the following year. In 1913, people were thinking, my God, you know, the world is getting ever more globalized, because at the time it was. The global economy was expanding at a rapid pace. There were these new technologies that were bringing people together across huge distances, like the telegraph and steamship and train. And people were imagining back in 1913 that this trend would continue and that the world would become ever more globalized. But then, of course, in 1914 came World War One, and not just World War One. What happened in 1914 was a major step backward, at least from the point of view of this global, emerging global economy. In fact, the world economy wouldn't regain its size from 1913 until the 1960s. This was basically a 50-year step backwards in terms of the output of the global economy and this trend of what we now call economic globalization. So this kind of beginning in the novel is an attempt to kind of take that feeling of 1913 and put ourselves into that place right now, in 2017 and 2018. Because, of course, right now we think, well, of course, the global economy is growing at a rapid pace. China has, you know, become this major, basically, capitalist country. And, you know, we have these new technologies that are tying us together, not just, of course, the internet and, you know, not just, you know, high-speed rail, but virtual reality and new techniques that are just, it seems, breaking down every conceivable barrier between countries, between communities, and that this kind of global economy and perhaps even a global political system is just around the corner. But, of course, if we are, in fact, repeating history, if we are, again, at a 1913 moment, then that's not going to happen. What we're going to see instead is a major step backward. And that is effectively what Splinterlands is about. It's about this kind of major step backwards in terms of globalization, and trying to kind of capture that understanding of what it was like when things began to fall apart back in 1913.
We're speaking with John Pfeffer about his new novel, Splinterlands, which was just published in December 2016 by Haymarket Books. Now, you point out that after the USSR imploded, which is a very profound example of splintering, instead of like moving towards more of a democratic socialism sort of thing, what appeared not just in the former Soviet Union, but more and more around the world was market authoritarianism. And then you point out that nationalism is on the rise and that we are experiencing kind of like a nationalist international. Would you just very briefly expand on those?
Sure. So with the end of communism, with the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991, there was an expectation among some that we would see the end of history, what was called the end of history. In other words, the great kind of ideological battles that had occupied humans for all of history were over, or so Francis Fukuyama argued in the essay and later book of that name, and that all the great passions that excited us, that made us go to battle, that prompted, you know, so many of the great events of history, well, those were all over, and that the future would basically be, well, it would look more or less like the boardroom in Brussels of the European Union, just a bunch of people sitting around chatting and talking about kind of wonkish policy matters. And all the passion will have kind of gone out of human affairs. Of course, that didn't happen. Instead, what we saw was, you know, this upsurge of nationalism in the wake of the end of both the Soviet Union and, of course, the end of Yugoslavia as well. And so history didn't end. In fact, we saw enormous bloodletting, enormous conflict, and we saw the asserting of national priorities above and beyond kind of the common interest either of humanity or of regions or what have you. So this is kind of what happened in the 1990s, and it wasn't just brief, it wasn't just temporary, because, of course, we're seeing the same thing today. If we kind of try to understand the trajectory of the European Union, for instance, one of the reasons why it's facing so many challenges is because of the rise of a number of nationalist leaders within the European Union who are not interested in any longer going along with kind of pan-European programs and proposals. This would include, of course, movements like Nigel Farage and the UK Independence Party in England, but it would include leaders as well, such as those in Eastern Europe, like Viktor Orban in Hungary. And so this kind of rise of nationalism, again, in our era, has created what seems to be a nationalist international. In other words, there are all these leaders, like Donald Trump, like Vladimir Putin, like Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, who not only are kind of asserting that their country is great again and that their country is kind of more important than any other country, but they seem even to have an affinity for one another. In other words, much has been made, of course, of the bromance between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, but it's not just that. It's that there seems to be a kind of connection between all of these leaders in their perspective and in their way of communicating with one another. And so that's why I call it a nationalist international. But of course, there could not possibly be anything like a nationalist international because it's a contradiction in terms. Nationalists don't believe in internationalism. And this is where I think, you know, the trajectory of Splinterlands derives its energy, that all of these nationalists have come to power, and it seems at the moment as if it's just kind of the way it's always been, although perhaps a little bit more extreme in the rhetoric. But if all of these leaders follow through on their programs, well, then it will necessarily lead not only to greater conflict between nations, but I would argue greater conflict within nations as well, as different populations begin to react in different ways to those strong-arm leaders.
So your wording of nationalist international is just one example for our listeners of how very clever you are in writing your book, Splinterlands. Now, Julian West is not a very nice guy. His family doesn't want to have much to do with him, but much of the action in the novel, and I'm going to be really careful not to give away too much because no spoilers. That's our intentions here anyway, but I don't think it'll be a spoiler to say that he's traveling around the world in the form of a virtual reality avatar, and he visits his estranged daughter, his only daughter, Rachel, who lives in Brussels, Belgium. And he's shocked by what he finds there. What does he find?
Well, here in Brussels, Julian discovers that, well, things have changed since he was last there, physically. As you point out, he only visits there through virtual reality. When he was there as a student, you know, he was quite young, and it was the heyday of the European Union, and Brussels, of course, is the center of the European Union. And it's this great kind of multicultural environment, and he loved it. He was young, and it was a great time for him. When he returns to Brussels many, many years later, well, the European Union is no more, and it's not even a memory for people any longer. And the country itself, Belgium, well, Belgium has always had difficulty kind of cohering as a country. It's always had difficulty kind of putting together governments, and there's been considerable kind of conflict between the French-speaking and the Dutch-speaking elements of the population. But it has held together to now. But when he visits it in 2050, well, there's no longer any pretense that the country has held together. It's split into a Flanders and a Wallonia. Not only that, but it basically looks a great deal like, well, Baghdad. I mean, Brussels looks like Baghdad. There's a green zone, which is relatively safe, and where the remnants of the middle class and the elite still live. And then there's a red zone, where a war of all against all is going on every day. And it's basically a war between, you know, different factions. I mean, it's too complicated even to describe all of the different conflicts. There's conflicts between fans of different soccer clubs. There's, you know, conflicts between, you know, Flemish and Walloons. But there's also conflict between sleepers, people who are adherents to what has remained of the Islamic Caliphate, and the kind of paramilitary forces that have emerged to fight these sleepers. And so this is just incredibly depressing for Julian West, because, of course, you know, he didn't want his book, Splinterlands, to predict the future and to come face to face with just the horrors of life in 2050 is incredibly dispiriting for him.
Yes, and his daughter, Rachel, kind of mocks him for how appalled he is by this splintering of the European Union, and particularly Europe that he remembered of cathedrals and art galleries and that sort of thing. And this is a quote from her. She said, "The very idea of Europe was constructed in opposition to Islam. At the Battle of Tours in 732, during the Crusades, against the Turks and the Ottoman Empire, what we see now is more consistent with those roots. Your Europe, the Europe of multicultural unity, was an evolutionary detour." End of quote. She kind of like throws that back at him.
Yes, she is. There's obviously some conflict between him and his daughter, and a conflict that goes back, well, a long way. And so any kind of conversation they're going to have is basically going to be a working out of larger kind of psychological kind of problems that they have in their relationship. But clearly, you know, she has become accustomed to Europe as it has become, whereas he is still kind of living in his dream world, essentially, of what it was like when he was in his 20s, which was, in many ways, that's part of his life. You know, she makes an important point about Europe, and that is, well, we tend to think at the moment, now, in 2017, that Europe is a given as it is, that the European Union is kind of the culmination of European history, going back to Charlemagne, going back to all the great moments of European history. But in fact, that's not what Europe, for most of its history, has been. Europe, for most of its history, has been kind of bloodletting at an enormous magnitude, not only between countries, not only between tribes, but between Europe and other parts of the world. And, of course, she references the Crusades, kind of a defining element of Europe. It's how it came to understand itself in opposition to the Ottoman Empire, and earlier in opposition to non-Europeans in the Levant, or what we now call the Middle East. And it's an important reminder for us today that the European Union is not inevitable. It is a construction, and it can, as with all constructions, be deconstructed. And Europe could return quite easily to earlier points when unity and multiculturalism were not the watchwords, were not the kind of elements of policy, but a time when, you know, in World War II, Europeans were killing each other in large numbers.
Well, speaking of the prelude to World War I, the Russian ambassador was recently assassinated, and there are headlines, an acrid whiff of 1914, ambassador's killing comes at a nervous time. So I hate to say it, but you know, your speculative fiction is looking less and less speculative with every headline, basically.
Yeah, I'm very, of course, uncomfortable with this. You know, I did not anticipate that any of these things would happen now. And of course, the book was designed for people to say, "Hey, we have to prevent these kind of conflicts, clashes, cleavages from developing any further." And of course, it's not too late to step back. I mean, it's not as if you know, we have, for instance, between the United States and Russia, you know, stepped over the line, and you know, it's irreversible, kind of emerging Cold War climate. And it's certainly not irreversible where the European Union is heading. Syria, well, of course, Syria is already, you know, descended into you know, a maelstrom, into a devastating civil war from which it's very, very difficult to imagine that any time soon the country can rebuild and recover. But for the time being, you know, the rest of the world, you know, has not kind of gone down that path. And to give you a more hopeful sign, I mean, take Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia, between 1991 and 1999, had four separate wars. And it seemed as if it would be impossible for that part of the world to ever recover, not only from war, but even from genocide, which took place in Bosnia. And yet today, not only have sections of the former Yugoslavia entered the European Union, Croatia, Slovenia, not only, you know, do we see Bosnia holding together as an entity that includes Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks, but we even see that countries that had been at war with one another, like Serbia and Croatia, actually rebuilding ties, rebuilding economic relations, political relations, cultural relations. And that has taken place, you know, only, you know, within 15 years. So for me, that is an extraordinarily hopeful sign that what we sometimes think of as being kind of irreversible, terrible events can, in fact, be ultimately reversed.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've been referring to Julian West's book, Splinterlands. Would you please give us a little bit of understanding of that? And also, is he the founder of geopaleontology?
Yes. So geopaleontology is this kind of idea that I came up with to describe this new discipline that Julian West founds. And now, up until, you know, 2020, when he publishes his book, he's basically a conventional political scientist. And he's written about the European Union, he's written about the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But in 2020, he decides that he's going to publish an entirely new kind of book that looks at the unraveling of large entities like the Soviet Union, and to understand why it happens, and to kind of think about what are the implications of the unraveling of these large structures. And he kind of dubs this new discipline geopaleontology because he's looking at geopolitics, but he's looking at it as a paleontologist would, as a paleontologist who digs up a dinosaur bone and tries to understand, well, how did this dinosaur go extinct? And so that's what Julian West is trying to figure out. Well, how did the Soviet Union go extinct? And he writes about that, and he's writing about it as other dinosaurs, in the geopolitical sense, are going extinct as well. And that's why his book is not only a work of history, but is also, in some sense, a work of futurology. Because as soon as he publishes his book in 2020, other dinosaurs immediately start going extinct as well. The European Union falls apart. The United States begins to fall apart. Russia, China, all of these huge multi-ethnic entities splinter. And the analysis that Julian West kind of puts forward in terms of understanding why the Soviet Union fell apart, that Yugoslavia fell apart, that becomes kind of the basis of this new discipline for understanding why all the rest of the world seems to be fragmented.
Now, I want to kind of take a little journey away from your book, Splinterlands, and refer to a piece that you wrote that was published in early December in Tom Dispatch. And when you were referring earlier to your editor, you were referring to Tom Engelhardt, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Well, you wrote what could be have been included in this book, in my opinion, and perhaps in future editions you will include it. It's written from the perspective of Julian West's estranged wife, I guess divorced wife, and I won't go into what her story is because that would be a bit of a spoiler, but she's talking about in the United States the things that contributed to the fragmentation here in this country. And I would really like it if you would share some of it with us, because it was a very fresh, for me anyway, take on our history. Of course, we had the Civil War, and that was when we could have just totally broken up, and we didn't. But she points out that from the very beginning, from the post-Revolutionary War period, there was this tension between the autonomy of the states and federalism. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that in splinterlands, the United States has broken up into, at least, among other things, the crazy country of Northern California. But she's talking, and by the way, I know people in Northern California who have advocated for that.
Absolutely.
So would you just share a little bit with us about how potentially precarious, regardless of the flooding of D.C., these United States are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an important question. So I didn't really include the ex-wife's story in Splinterlands, and in part because it was from his point of view, and it was important for narrative reasons to kind of tell the story from his point of view and have his story undercut by, you know, the annotator and by his children, but still consistently seen through his eyes. But in this other essay, I did want to kind of look at the same set of history, but from her perspective, and also to incorporate kind of some of the missing pieces of what happened to the United States in this scenario. And of course, I was able to write it after the election, so it takes into consideration the election of Donald Trump. And you know, what she says is basically, you know, back in 2016, 2017, and she again is writing from the time of 2050 or so. Back in 2016, 2017, people were focused on this kind of what seemed to be a unbridgeable divide between red states and blue states, between liberals and conservatives. But they missed what was a more important underlying division in the United States. And that was a division that went all the way back to the very founding of the country, to the time, in fact, before we had a constitution, before we were in some sense the United States, because there was a period of 6 or 7 years between the end of the Revolutionary War and the Constitutional Convention. And during that period, we lived under the Articles of Confederation. There were these states that had, you know, broken away from British rule and were perfectly happy living as states, as Virginia, as Maryland. And we're not interested in creating a federation, of joining together, and so they were living under these articles. But basically, our founding fathers pulled a fast one, kind of a bait and switch. They said, well, we'll have this convention, but it'll be to kind of, you know, improve on the Articles of Convention, Articles of Confederation. But instead, what they did is they came together in Philadelphia, and they created an entirely new country, got rid of the Articles of Confederation, and wrote a constitution. And in that constitution, you could find still the elements of disagreement between this state perspective and a federal perspective. And this division between, you know, the rights and prerogatives of states and the rights and prerogatives of a federal center has been at the heart of the American enterprise ever since. And it, of course, as you said, came to greatest conflict during the Civil War, in which states asserted their states' rights to do whatever they wanted, of course, the southern states, against Abraham Lincoln and the Union, which asserted the federal prerogative to make policy. And it would seem as though that war ended that particular conflict, but it didn't, because the conflict between states' rights and the federal center has continued and continues today. And I would, and as I put in her mouth, argue that the constituency that Donald Trump so effectively mobilized was not just folks who were unhappy about, you know, the global economy, felt left behind by transformations politically and technologically in this country, but they were upset about what they perceived as the federal government's infringement on their rights, either as states or individuals. And it was a kind of replay of the conflicts we've seen in this country for the last more than 200 years. This, she says, is what ultimately led to the unraveling of the United States, because it wasn't just that you had states like southern states saying, hey, we don't want the federal government to kind of infringe on our right, for instance, to have creationism in our textbooks, or to have crutches on our lawns, or to ban abortion. But it was on the other side of the political spectrum as well. California saying, hey, you know, we are not happy with the dismantling of the EPA, and we want to preserve our better environmental standards. Or other states saying, we don't agree with, you know, the immigration policy, and so we're going to create a sanctuary state or sanctuary city. And so it was across the political spectrum, states essentially asserting their, you know, priority over and above federal power, that led to the fragmentation of the United States and the creation of that crazy country of Northern California, as well as where his ex-wife lives, which is Vermont, and this kind of Northeast kingdom that emerges as an agricultural paradise because of climate change.
Well, actually, she lives in the Republic of Vermont and New Hampshire.
Yes.
On a commune called Arcadia.
Yes.
So there is this period of the few decades on either side of the new millennium of, you can't really say it's peace, because there's stuff going all around the world that's not peaceful. But in terms of Europe, it's more or less consolidated and peaceful. But then comes the great polarization. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things we've been struggling with in our times is polarization at both an economic and a political, and frankly a cultural level as well. At the economic level, we've seen, you know, incredible income inequality worsen at a time when we were told that, you know, all boats would rise if the waters rise, but in fact the waters have risen. In other words, you know, the global economy has gotten larger, but only some boats have risen, not all boats. And in fact, increasingly small number of boats have risen. We've seen the proliferation of billionaires and you know, huge fortunes made, even as people slip into poverty around the world. So we've seen that throughout the world. I mean, not just, you know, greater income inequality in the United States, but even in Europe, which has spent such efforts over the last several decades to counter precisely those trends. So that's the economic polarization. Political polarization, well, I mean, here in the United States, we have seen, of course, the inability of our political institutions to bridge the political gaps that we've been experiencing over the last several decades. But it's not just our country. I mean, we've seen kind of a polarization take place around the world as the conventional political structures have not been able to sustain support among the population. And then the cultural polarization as well. It seems every day less and less ability to reach across different cultural viewpoints to find common ground. So in Splinterlands, all three of these kind of polarizing trends kind of reach their supreme expression as countries just cannot cohere any longer. They cannot come to any kind of agreement about national priorities. And that essentially the compact that people of different backgrounds have made traditionally to keep nation states going, well, they no longer hold. And with the nation state no longer kind of serving this kind of function of bringing people together, well, the nation state falls apart. And this, of course, takes place in the novel all over the place, but one of the most salient examples is China, where enormous income inequality has persisted and in a country which, ideologically speaking, has committed itself to some form of equality. And that, when the economy goes south in China, in other words, when it can no longer sustain double-digit or even high single-digit economic growth from year to year, well, the population says, forget about it. We're not going to support the Communist Party any longer. And they withdraw their political support. The Communist Party can no longer kind of maintain control of the country. And various parts of the country as well break away, whether it's Xinjiang or Tibet or the southern regions of Yunnan. China falls apart. And this becomes, and this, of course, is very consistent with Chinese history, because China's history is full of the fragmentation, the warring periods between different states. And China simply reverts to form. It goes back to an earlier historical model.
We're speaking with John Pfeffer about his very interesting dystopian novel, Splinterlands. Well, that brings us to Julian West's elder son, Gordon. Now, Gordon is a piece of work. What had been Western China in Xinjiang, and that's a very interesting place because that's where the Gulf State folks have gone with all their money, because, of course, with climate change, the Gulf states are absolutely unlivable. Talk about Gordon, please.
Sure. So Gordon is, I guess if you wanted to give him some kind of a psychological profile, he'd be kind of high-functioning, autistic, very, very talented, very smart, doesn't necessarily have a great capacity to deal with other people, rather low on his emotional empathy scale. But what that means is when you combine his incredible mathematical and economic gifts with his low empathy abilities, it means that he is ruthless. He's able to make money off of other people's suffering, which is what he does. He comes up with a kind of complicated economic algorithm that makes it possible for him to make money on chaos. And, of course, that's what is happening from 2018 to 2050, enormous amounts of chaos. So anybody who can bet on chaos, as Gordon does, will make a lot of money. Now, he has, as well, a somewhat difficult relationship with his father, and without giving away any spoilers, suffice it to say that Julian West is not happy with what seems to be the amoral life trajectory of his son Gordon. But Gordon pushes back, just as his daughter had pushed back in Brussels. Gordon says, "Look, it's not like you were behaving all that morally either. I mean, you wrote a book and you profited on chaos as well. Your book was all about chaos, and you got royalties from that. So why are you getting on my case? And so this becomes, you know, another kind of emblematic confrontation in which Julian should be examining his own kind of motives, his own past. Julian has difficulty doing that. He'd rather criticize his children.
Yeah, like I said, Julian's not a very nice guy. We don't have a lot of sympathy for him. So that brings up the financial meltdown of 2023. Do you think you can talk about that without giving over too many spoilers?
Sure. Well, you know, we have already experienced quite a number of financial meltdowns in our own kind of recent past. Certainly, you know, the Asian financial crisis back in the 1990s, and then, of course, the rise and fall of the internet boom, and then the mortgage crisis of the late 2000s, and the implosion of banks, not only here in the United States, but around the world. So financial crisis, I mean, it's something we've come to live with, essentially. And it's not that difficult to imagine that these crises, rather than simply being kind of cyclical, happening every so often, and signaling what economists call the creative destruction of the market, in other words, kind of bankrupting a bunch of unprofitable industries and allowing for new kind of entrepreneurial energy and new businesses to kind of come in to that vacuum and prosper and recreate economies. So that, of course, is the cyclical approach that economists say is what will continue into the future. But in Splinterland, that isn't what happens, of course. What happens is that it all leads up to kind of a major breakdown of the international financial system, as it simply becomes untenable as a system. And it's, you know, it is undone by the greed of the actors, like Gordon, as well as the corrupt kind of corruption of many of the participants as well. And the financial system, since it's become weighted so much to the production of wealth for an ever smaller number of people, it cannot any longer pretend to be an economic system for everyone. And as a result, it loses both the confidence of investors as well as the confidence of your average everyday person. Financial system simply falls apart. And now the financial system is, if you can imagine it, kind of the circulatory system of our global world, that without the IMF or the World Bank or kind of currency trading, without, you know, Wall Street and the London Exchange, without all of these major features, the global economy cannot survive. I mean, it too will collapse as a result. And the international system as a whole, if it's deprived of a global economy that provides it with kind of its economic support, well, the global system too will fall apart. So this is really what kind of precipitates the fragmenting of the whole world, the great unraveling that begins in 2018, 2019, really accelerates after the financial collapse in the early 2020.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to quote the book here briefly. In 2023, when the dollar fell from its perch as a global currency, the U.S. government went into receivership, and its vast overseas military footprint became unsupportable. As it withdrew, Washington deputized its allies, Germany, Japan, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, Israel, to do the same work. But they regularly operated at cross purposes and, in any case, began to fragment themselves, beginning with the secessions of Okinawa, Bavaria, and Saudi Arabia's eastern provinces, in the mid-2020s. So here and there arose what you refer to as democratic dictatorships. Very briefly, talk about those.
Sure. So there's this kind of new concept that people call democratura. In other words, this kind of fusion of democracy and dictatorship that has emerged around the world. And perhaps it's reached its kind of its greatest expression in Vladimir Putin in Russia. He's been elected. He operates within a democratic system. But he has both undermined that democratic system and shaped it for his own purposes in order to centralize power in his own hands. And he's centralized power to such a degree that even Dmitry Medvedev, who, you know, previously had quite a high profile on the international stage, seems to be nothing more than a minor appendage to as prime minister to President Putin's power. And Putin has and have cultivated similar, democratic authoritarians in other countries. He has great friendships, for instance, with Viktor Orban in Hungary, who also was elected and also has concentrated his power. This wasn't, of course, you know, engaging in futurology to imagine that these kind of these hybrid politicians would be populating the world stage, because, of course, we have many of them with us right now. And it seems as though this is kind of the answer that the world has provided to a set of problems. And that the problem is, for instance, the difficulty of nation states to operate in the world economy because of the great speed at which financial transactions take place, the degree to which the world economy undermines nation-state authority, the problem of political popular participation. And people are just less and less interested in voting, for instance, or being engaged in politics. And in many countries, public opinion polls say again and again that people want, you know, someone with authority to kind of make things work. They don't care so much any longer about whether the person is particularly democratic or adheres to the rule of law. They just want things to get done. And so these two problems in particular, the problem of how a nation state deals with the global economy and the fact that our current kind of deadlocked political structures don't seem to answer people's needs to see things get done, produce these this answer of basically democratic authoritarian leaders. And so I think we are now kind of facing our own example of that here in the United States, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, of course, here in the United States, but there'll be more importantly, interesting to see how people react to that and whether they will say, well, we're having second thoughts about whether we want that kind of political system here in the United States.
Well, we won't have time to go into the youngest child of Julian West, Benjamin, but in some ways he's the most interesting. But it does bring up the evil corporation CRISPR very briefly, like 30 seconds. Tell us about CRISPR.
So CRISPR is a current technology. It's basically genetic engineering, a very promising technology that we might be able to see the end of cancer and other major diseases. But of course, as with any technology, it can be used for both good and for bad. And in this book, the CRISPR Corporation, it's not exactly your friendly neighborhood corporation. It has rather large ambitions, and those ambitions are not necessarily nice ambitions. And so they play kind of the negative role in the book. It's one more example of kind of future technologies and how they will kind of have an influence on these larger geopolitical trends.
Okay, well, I think that's about all the time we have. John, I really, really am very enthusiastic about this book, Splinterlands. I hope that word gets out and that sales are brisk for you. And I wish you all the best in the new year. Thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.